Whether you call them wheels or orbs or discs or flying dragons, there are 500 or more cases in this new book, Wonders in the Sky by Jacques Vallée. And it's amazing as you read these cases how often these things seem to appear to what we would call great people, a pharaoh, the Chinese emperor, Alexander the Great, Michelangelo, and even to Jacques Vallée himself. You will have to wonder as well if that's on purpose, if it's some sort of a display. We'll get into that with Jacques Vallée as soon as we come back after this break on Coast to Coast AM. Thanks for being with us. We're talking with Jacques Vallée about his new book, Wonders in the Sky. And it's amazing the descriptions of different craft and objects that are seen in the sky over these 500 cases and hundreds of years. A case from 1752 in Russia about someone who was abducted in a, quote, flying cauldron. Another one from the same year in Norway of a flying octagon. One from 1745 London, a flying trumpet. And 1748 Scotland, globes of light. All kinds of different descriptions. And what amazes to me, as I teased a couple of minutes ago, how many of these cases involve great leaders, great people from history, a pharaoh, a Chinese emperor. Alexander the Great had one or more instances. Michelangelo, as Jacques mentioned, and Jacques, I should say that you've had your own case. Do you think that is an accident that these things appear to what we would call great people?
Well, I think it's simply the filter of history. That if it appeared to some peasant somewhere, probably the person would not have been able to read and write in those years, and the ones that come to us because they appear to a king or to a pharaoh or to a bishop were recorded because he was surrounded by scholars and clerks and people who could write. I think those are the ones that have survived and were felt to be important.
I should point out that although you've written a lot of UFO books, you are by no means a UFO believer, not in the classic sense. I mean, you believe there's a legitimate phenomena there, but you have really put it to the mainstream UFO community over the years, suggesting that some of their central theses are flat out wrong. You know, we, as you have said, we don't exactly know what it is, this intelligence, but you were the first to write that probably the vast amount of these incidents and cases belie the theory that the ET explanation is the best explanation, that it just doesn't seem to make sense. In looking at these 500 cases from years gone by, did they affect your views in that regard? Did they alter your views about what it might be?
That was a frequent topic of discussion between Chris Solbeck and me. He has a more detached, I think, view of that. He should speak for himself. But in my, my interpretation of his position a little bit more cautious. What I'm criticizing is the first degree, the first level ET explanation. I mean, that these are spacecraft that come from some other planet and they come here to save us or to conquer us or to steal materials from us and so on. I mean, that is the first thing you can think of when you begin to study this material. And I, the first two books I wrote back in the 60s, in the mid and late 60s, took that approach. And it's always, as I said, we know that there must be life equal or superior to our consciousness, to our intelligence, throughout the universe. It's a big cosmos out there, and I studied astronomy and I still love astronomy, and now we keep discovering new planets, including planets similar to the Earth. So that only reinforces that view that was controversial in the 60s, but now it's mainstream. It's about time. However, when you look at the patterns, which as a scientist, a theory is only as good as the explanations that it provides for the facts. And when we look at the observations themselves, it doesn't account for what people are reporting. People are not reporting a spacecraft. They're reporting a whole range of phenomena, and there is no simplistic explanation. And if anything, doing this work in the last 6 years on the ancient sightings has sort of nailed that for me, that there is no simple explanation. It's not you know, chariots of the gods. You know, it's not something like that, as seductive as it could be. However, that doesn't mean that they are not from outer space, or that form of consciousness doesn't have a link beyond the Earth. I mean, if they can do, they, you know, in the hypothetical they, in quotes, they can do what the witnesses described, that could be from anywhere, anytime. They have obviously mastered gravity, they have mastered time beyond what our science can account for today. Now, I'm a strong believer in science. I think science eventually will understand all this. I could be wrong, but it's not a simple spacecraft where you can just go there and kick the tires. At the center of any theory about UFOs, whether it's a paranormal, parapsychological, Jungian, and so on, you have to account for the fact that there is a machine there. There is a technology, and I've never said otherwise. That's really why I continue to be interested. I mean, I'm very interested in the physics of it. In my current work, I've narrowed down my work to just a few cases that involve traces, involve material, involve electronic communication, things that we begin to make sense of in a somewhat primitive way. But we've collected. There is material that has been recovered after some of the close encounters that we can analyze. We're beginning to find some patterns in the physics. We're beginning to have some ideas about the electromagnetic communication, or at least the electromagnetic phenomena that surround these things. And little by little, we're converging on a pattern, or at least not an understanding yet, but at least a model of what that technology can be. But it's not all there is. There is much more than just technology involved, and that's what you see in these ancient Chinese writers and poets were talking about a machine. They were talking about a contraption of some sort, and there were descriptions of things crashing to the ground. There were descriptions of traces. There are descriptions of medical effects, paralysis, intense heat when the object flew over them, certainly medical effects and certainly psychological effects that are similar to what modern witnesses are describing to us.
You know, you are familiar, of course, with this ranch in Utah where we've written something about it. And, you know, these different phenomena appear to different people at different times. It seems like whatever it is, it decides when it's seen, where it's seen, and who gets to see it, almost as if it's a display, a show. In your writings over the years, you've written that it seems to be, one theory being, that it's almost like a control system, that whatever it is, it keeps us under control in ways by appearing at different times to different people. It in effect intervenes in the course of human affairs. And you have said that this control system theory that you have is testable. And I'd like to know if you ever tested it. And if not, is that still doable?
Well, I didn't mean necessarily that there was an intelligence, you know, a supreme intelligence controlling it or directing it. The phenomenon has the information characteristics of a control system. It comes in waves. It responds to certain things. I've never published this, but I will someday. As you know, one of the things I want to leave behind is a record of my own research called Forbidden Science, and I've published two volumes so far, and they are, you know, sort of not widely published, but they are on record, and I want to continue to do that. In the 90s, I tried to create sort of an artificial thing like the ranch in Utah, and this was, of course, before the events at the ranch. I tried to create a hotspot of information where I was hoping to sort of attract the phenomenon to be able to record it better. And it didn't give the results I was hoping for. It's not something that you can just decide to engage with, or at least I haven't found a way to do it. But it's worth continuing to try, because there seems to be a form of consciousness behind it that is extremely subtle, has a great sense of humor, is completely ruthless. I mean, I know from reading your book, you know, and actually being there, what happened at that ranch. There is no simplistic explanation.
And not just at the ranch, in general, across the world. I mean, this thing is it toys with people. It messes with their minds, and you always have to wonder what the heck kind of agenda is going on here, if there is even an agenda at all.
Well, you know, I studied physics, but I certainly don't consider myself a physicist. I'm trained in information science, and in information science and logic, you often have situations, well, even in mathematics, where you have contradictions in the material you're looking at. And the solution is to go up a level. It's not to fight it and try to force it into a preconceived idea. It's certainly true in mathematics. That's why, you know, imaginary numbers were invented. There are no imaginary numbers. But when you invent the concept, it enables you to do things in mathematics about real things that you couldn't do before. So I think that's probably what we will have to do with this, is go up a level, not be so fascinated by the day-to-day cases and the sightings and the databases, which are, of course, you need to do, but you need to go up and take a wider view of this. And I think that's very much what the direction that Chris is going. Chris is going to write, you know, many more books. He has amazing material in many areas of this, and he'll continue to publish it, I hope. One of the remarkable things in this book is when you get to the 17th and 18th century, you get to the Enlightenment, and then you find that the witnesses are astronomers. Some of the greatest names in science, Arago, Messier, you know, the discoverer of what is now known as galaxies, the Messier objects. Cassini, the director of Paris Observatory. Of course, Arago was director as well. Le Verrier, who discovered Neptune. All of them were involved in this, in looking, actually inviting people to send them observations of unknown objects in the sky. The science was open. It was, in those days, it was great glory for an astronomer to attach his name to a new phenomenon, and scientists were completely open to the idea of this correspondence between astronomers and the mathematician Gauss, for example, about objects that were very puzzling to them. There are descriptions by Lagrange of a series of objects moving through the sky in military fashion and turning together, and those were not just, you know, a train of meteors. Cassini made two observations of something that seemed to be in orbit near Venus. And he didn't publish, these were careful scientists. He didn't publish it because he was the only one who had seen it. And he only published it when he saw it a second time a few years later. Now, these are careful men who've attached their name to some of the, you know, the great discoveries of the 18th century, and there you are. I mean, these are the records that we have forgotten, and when you see the academic arrogance that we encounter today of people just not even wanting to look at the records, even the records from pilots or records from the Air Force or from the Navy, they just won't even look at it. They will dismiss it with out of hand, with ridicule. The science has fallen to a terrible level of arrogance.
And of course, as you know, today, these days, the critics, the ultra skeptics and diehard debunkers, they like to say that no scientists ever see this stuff, astronomers never see this stuff. And it looks like we've gone backwards instead of forwards, at least in this regard, from the 8 days of the Enlightenment that you describe in this book.
Yes, absolutely. It's a shame.
And scientists today, it seems like there's a gap between what the religion that they have embraced and the reality of what millions of people around the planet see. Now, of course, as you know, 90-95% of what people see in the sky is explainable, but that other 5% gets dismissed altogether, and nobody wants to hear about it. Don't even want to look at it.
Well, and that's, I think, culturally very dangerous, because people know that. So they, you know, if an educated person sees something in the sky, they don't want to be laughed at by some astronomer who's going to ridicule them or dismiss them. So they don't report it, or they, you know, hopefully they will report it to someone like me or somebody who's been publishing research on it, or contact some of the UFO groups. But most witnesses today just keep it to themselves.
I do want to say, you mentioned your two-volume work, Forbidden Science. I had read the first volume some years ago, and then last year, when I saw you, you were kind enough to give me a copy of the second one. And if people want to understand, I know this is not a book for the masses. It's sort of your personal journey of discovery. But if people want to understand how Jacques Vallée came to sort of where he is now and is thinking about these subjects, this is what you need to read. Forbidden Science, Volume 2 is just an excellent book. And really, I'm surprised how candid you were about some of your thoughts and sharing your personal life with the readership.
Well, I think it has to be in the context of, you know, the researcher's own path. In a way, this is also, you know, a spiritual journey for me, and I feel, you know, honored to be able to work on this with a small cadre of people, of scientists and of researchers, of investigators like you, and try to make sense out of it. It's the greatest mystery that has been presented to us. And again, at the center, there is, I don't disagree with Leslie Keene or with Richard Dolan. I mean, he was kind enough to ask me to write a foreword to his first book. I don't disagree with their position that there is a technology there. The question, I think what I'm trying to contribute is the sense that there is no simplistic explanation. We shouldn't just jump to conclusions about this.
You are a skeptic in many regards. And in this book, Wonders in the Sky, you take on a little bit Eric von Daniken, Zechariah Sitchin. I mean, I would imagine at some point, as you're looking at 500 cases from antiquity on up, that you had to cross paths with some of the same cases and incidents and evidence that these guys have interpreted in their own way, right?
Yes, I also crossed paths with Alexander Kazantsev in Russia, who was one of the originators of all of that. We get to an area where I'm not really competent to speak, you know, cultural anthropology and so on, and the history of religion. Chris and I, the book is in three parts, and what we've been talking about is the chronology itself, which is the first part, the largest one. But the second part looks at the cases that we've rejected, which includes a lot of cases that are in the UFO literature and, you know, have to do with chariots of the gods and all those interpretations, many of which we dismiss because, again, it's a simplistic explanation. Of course, the gods can do anything if they could, you know, they could come down here. But again, what the material we have doesn't reflect that kind of thing. It doesn't fit that theory. And a theory is only as good as what it explains, you know. And at some point, you have to take a skeptical, not a cynical, but a skeptical view of it, and really dig into the material and ask, you know, try to explain it fully.
Skeptical is a good word. It's just been hijacked in our time, Jacques. We're going to take a break. We'll come back with more of our fascinating interview with Jacques Vallée, author of the new book Wonders in the Sky, right after this on Coast to Coast AM. And here on Coast to Coast, we're tangled up with a tangled web of ufology. You know, it's perplexing, it's frustrating, and few people have been at it as long as Jacques Vallée. Few people have dug as deep or have tried to understand it more than Jacques Vallée, but somehow You know, the same issues, the same questions arise again and again, year after year, decade after decade. And you have to wonder if we will ever have any clear answers. Certainly, if we are going to have it, it's because of the work of people like Jacques. When we come back, we'll finish our discussion of Wonders in the Sky, his new book, and also bring it up to date with some of the current controversies in ufology and see what Jacques Vallée thinks about them. Stay with us for more Coast to Coast AM. Jacques Vallée, we've covered some of the highlights of your, I guess it's close to 60 years, 50 years that you've been chasing the UFO mystery and trying to figure it out. I wonder if this thought has occurred to you. You know, a few people have been at it as long as you or have done as important work. Whether or not it will be ultimately frustrating for you if you don't have the answers during your time here, if you can't resolve the mystery in your mind, that's got to drive you crazy.
No. You know, science is never finished. I had the privilege of working on a new phenomenon or something that wasn't commonly recognized and of making a contribution to it, calling it to the attention of people. I think I work every day with physicists and with doctors, with medical people who've been working on, cancer for 60 years, and we still can't cure cancer. We're making progress, and there are new theories and new hopes. The same thing in physics. I mean, we still can't reconcile relativity with quantum mechanics, especially with respect to gravitation. And you have to realize that these are difficult problems, and they take time. And We you're a worker like any other worker. You're never finished, and hopefully you make your contribution. You bring a little, I've seen during my career, I also had the privilege of working with some of the pioneers of the Internet, with people like Paul Barron, who invented packet switching, people like Doug Engelbart, who did the first, arguably the first social network at Stanford Research Institute, where I was in the 70s, and I've told those stories. It's not finished. I mean, we still don't know what the ultimate, we're just at the beginning of the Internet and the web. We don't know what form is going to take, in 20 years. But the pleasure is having brought a few stones to the edifice. You know, we're building something here. It's also a lot of fun. I think Chris and I were carried forward by, and the whole team, by just these extraordinary discoveries that we were making, including things that turned out to be, to have been invented completely by some, spurious, author, where we could finally prove that the thing never happened. Things that turned out to be comets that had been quoted in the UFO literature for a long time. It ties to history, it ties to genealogy, it ties to a lot of extraordinary things. So, for example, the first congressional hearings on UFOs took place on December 15, 1813. Some ufologists keep calling for congressional hearings. Well, they happened in 1813. There were lights seen over the shore of Connecticut. And, of course, there was a war going on between the United States and England and the colonies in England at those days. And the question was, what were those lights? Was it created by traitors signaling to the English fleet? And there were very intense hearings and arguments in Congress about these unknown lights in the sky. And I think Decatur was involved in those discussions and so on. So you learn a lot about the history and a lot about culture as you go through this.
And amazingly enough, Congress did not resolve the mystery of the unexplained lights back then or in the 60s.
Exactly. They don't seem to be doing a very good job of explaining it.
You have also jumped in headfirst, and on one level, I guess I should not be surprised, given your inquisitive nature, into another sort of cutting-edge phenomena, and that's remote viewing. We read a couple of years ago that you had done some training yourself, and I wonder I don't know how much you are willing to talk about that, but whether or not it has contributed to your understanding of the UFO phenomena.
Well, that's a whole other discussion.
And yeah,
we,
I know.
We could go into that at some point.
Okay.
I was at SRI actually before the remote viewing program started, or just at the same time. I was just in one of the computer departments working with Dr. Engelbart, who had invented the mouse. He had already invented all of that, so I can take no credit for it. But we worked together on the early days of the ARPANET. SRI had machine number 2 on the ARPANET. I don't need to tell you how many millions of machines there are today on the Internet. And so those were exciting days, and the remote viewing project was just a few offices away. And many of the, quote, psychics, for lack of a better term, had seen UFOs. So I became sort of a friend of the court or an advisor to the program, even though at the time I was not cleared for the program, but I had many contacts with the psychics involved. I was cleared later in the 80s, but when I was at SRI, when Ingo Swann arrived, I had many discussions at lunch with Ingo, and was absolutely fascinated with the things that he was doing and demonstrating. And we talked about, I talked to him in terms of information patterns, because I deal with information. And in what it seemed to me that what he was doing was addressing information, except it was information that wasn't there. It was on the other side of the world. And transferring his consciousness in some mysterious way to those places. So I took him through a quick briefing or a course in information addressing from a computer point of view. And that's how the idea of coordinate remote viewing started. I didn't talk about it for a long time because when I was cleared for Grill Flame in the 80s, of course, this was a secret project. And I think I'm the only one who hasn't written a book about it. And by now, all of that, or practically all of it, has been declassified. So Ingo asked me to give a talk in Las Vegas a couple of years ago about those days, about the early days of the program. And I did. I think it's all over the Internet now. So I have no problem talking about it.
Did you ever use remote viewing, and as so many remote viewers have done, encounter some kind of intelligence or see a UFO while you're in that state?
I have not. I have experienced. I was trained by Ingo. I'm not a very good remote viewer, but I'm good enough to understand what it is and what you feel and what it does. I remember a case where I was given a set of coordinates and instantly I had vertigo, and I was on top of a peak somewhere with a precipice all around me. It turned out to be the top of a very, very high mountain, and that came immediately, and I'll always remember that. And I had a number of experiences of that type. I think if I have any talent, it's not remote viewing. It's probably in some other area.
Let's you know what? We'll have to have you back for an entire show about that. I'll twist your arm with that. Let's talk about some current developments in ufology that seem to pop up year after year. I want to get your take on them. You and I had the pleasure of meeting and interviewing Phil Corso back in the 1990s. We talked to him here in Las Vegas and also saw him in Florida. And he of course, he's a credible guy, an interesting guy who told an incredible story about recovered technology being salted out into private industry. What is your take, not necessarily just on Corso, but on the whole crash retrieval stuff that our government has pieces of flying saucers somewhere? Do we not have enough time for that? I mean, in general,
I can give you a quick answer. I don't want to evade the question as much as I'd like to. I was enormously impressed by Corso, by Phil Corso. I tend to be enormously impressed by anything who saved Europe from fascism. And there is no question he was a brave soldier. Made it clear to us that he was a soldier, not a physicist. So he did not know really what these things were. You know Colonel Alexander, and he's publishing a book in a couple of months that includes a very, very detailed intelligent analysis of the Corso statement. So I would really defer to Colonel Alexander for that.
Okay.
Because he went through his military history, where he had been, why he said some of the things he said, and so on. My impression was that Phil Corso was telling us the truth as he believed it.
Well, let me ask it in a more generic sense. Do you believe that our military, our government, has pieces of a flying saucer that's from somewhere else?
Well, Corso said a couple of things that are impossible. For example, you know, about transistors. Well, I work every day with people. I mean, the invention of the transistor is within human memory. I work with people like Dr. Federico Fagin, for example, who is, you know, right here in Silicon Valley and was the inventor of the microcomputer, the integrated circuit. I mean, all of that, we know the people who did it. Many of them are still alive. They didn't get it from Roswell. You can trace that technology through all its extraordinary technology. It happened very fast, but physically it made sense. I mean, every step is understood. And we have their laboratory notebooks. We know how they made the discoveries, where every experiment went, and so on. And we're still, of course, developing that technology. So the idea that came from Roswell makes absolutely no sense. The thing about fiber optic, well, it was known for a long time, even the 30s and before, that a wire of glass carries light. And in fact, it was used in art and it was used in instrumentation by glassmakers a long time before people thought about using it for fiber optic communication. So those things make no sense. I mean, the transistor was first described, the field effect was first described in a German patent in 1934. So there is a continuity there in human memory and human technology. That's just development of technology. What intrigued me the most about Phil Corso was his encounter with an entity in the desert. And that it was something he did not understand, that made a profound impression in his life, and it's not in his book, because the people who actually edited his book thought that was a little bit too strange, and they wanted to stay within the dogma of, crashed material and that kind of thing. The government, well, I don't know how, and there are people who do a good job of filing FOIA requests and digging into what the government must have known and so on, and about Roswell and other things. And I wish them well, and I'm glad that they have the
tenacity,
the courage, and the to do this. That's not something where I can contribute very much. I like to talk to, but this is a phenomenon that's all around us. You can talk to farmers who've seen the thing close by on their field. And I can go talk to them, and that's what I like doing. And many of them want to be anonymous because they don't want to talk to the media. They don't want to talk to the Air Force. They don't want the government involved. But they'll talk to people like me and to researchers. And so we have access to the phenomenon, even to pieces of metal that are found after some of these, and we can analyze them and so on. So I like the, the quiet Silicon Valley approach where you just do that work in stealth mode with your own resources. And I don't have the resources to do what should be done, which would be a larger scale study. So I concentrate on the things that I can do, which is looking at technology. Now, the government must have tons of records. We know that because we talk to pilots who say, when I landed, there were two guys there in blue jeans, and they confiscated all my material, and they took it somewhere, and they told me not to talk about it. So this must go somewhere. Now, it's not necessarily the CIA or the Air Force. We don't know where these guys in blue jeans come from. they violate many of the rules of handling of classified information. So who is it that can do that? I don't have the answer to that. I'm not so sure that it's a government agency, although we know, of course, that government agencies have accumulated stuff simply because they have sensors everywhere that are triggered by the phenomenon. So, of course, those people have classified clearances, and they can't talk to the guy in the next cubicle. So that's not the kind of research I can do. I'm not so hopeful that we can... I mean, obviously, the thing to do, and I've said that time and again, this stuff should be turned over to science. And let science compete, let different labs and different teams come up with their best idea to do research on this in a competitive basis. I mean, that's the way the Internet was built. That's the way we do research on everything else. I mean, what are they afraid of? What are they afraid of?
I guess ultimately they're not, you know, and that's, I wanted to ask you one more question, your view on disclosure, because Rich Dolan and Bryce Zabel will be here in the next, at the top of the hour, to talk about after disclosure, AD. You believe that there is some sort of a storehouse of information, perhaps in government hands, perhaps in private hands, that could be disclosed. Do you think it's going to happen? I mean, is there any impetus, anything that could force
it? When people talk about disclosure, they don't talk about my disclosure.
Right.
The question is, well, disclosure of what?
Yeah.
These are the mainstream ufology today believes that the government has a proof of contact with extraterrestrials, including perhaps bodies or maybe live extraterrestrials. Well, how do they know that? You have testimony from credible people who say that there is something like that. So, yeah, let's track it down. But the disclosure that I'd like would simply be, turn the data that, strip it of any classified information. If it was a classified radar somewhere, I don't need to know how the radar works, but give us the data. Give us, just the facts, ma'am, and let science work on it. I don't think it's going to be very simple. It may take a couple of generations of scientists, but at least we will know. I mean, the public is not going to panic. In a case like this, it's the elites that panic because they're afraid of losing power. But the public, your audience, the people listening to us now, they can take it. I mean, they've thought about this. Many of them probably have seen things themselves. They know there's something there. There is more than what we see every day, and around us. It's a big universe. So why are they so afraid?
Jacques Vallée, it's been wonderful to have you here. I sure hope that you will grace us with your presence again sometime. And wish you the best of luck. I encourage people to buy this book, Wonders in the Sky, and congratulate you and Chris Aubeck on writing it, because it's a fascinating procedure. And I hope this hasn't been too painful, and you'll come back and see us sometime.
It's a pleasure, and please give my warm regards to Richard.
I will. I will do that. Thank you very much, Jacques.
Thanks,
appreciate
Jacques.
It. Good night. And, we have looked at sort of the before with Jacques Vallée, these 500 cases from antiquity through the beginning of modern times. Next, after the break, after disclosure with Bryce Zabel and Rich Dolan, sort of the beginning, the before and the after. Stay with us here on Coast to Coast AM. Lots more to come.